I'm Marvin Landsverk, and I'm as excited as possible for someone of Norwegian extraction to be here today to talk about Blake with you. And the title of this series this week that I'm doing is Seeing Wisdom, Hearing Wisdom, Speaking Wisdom, William Blake and the Bible. And today's session title is called William Blake and Biblical Wisdom Books. So, got a few things I'd like to say just in introduction and to get us going, but I have this idea, this fantasy really, that Holden Villagers should be a great audience for a discussion of Blake, and better, I think, than my typical students at Montana State University, just because to read Blake, you have to know something about the Bible, because he's always had the Bible on his mind. And I mean, I teach a mythology class frequently, and most of the students in there really know very little about the Bible, so much of what's on his mind makes absolutely no sense to them. But I was trying to think if I knew any wisdom jokes when I was coming up here, and I don't, but I do know one advice joke, so I mean, I think this might count or come close. Oops. It's about an industrial consultant. He's an efficiency expert giving an analysis at a plant about efficiency procedures, and he was wrapping up, and he finished up by saying, "Don't try this at home." And someone came up afterwards and said, "Well, what do you mean, don't try this at home? It works here. You think your techniques would work at home?" And the guy says, "Well, I have tried them at home myself, so on good experience, I advise you not to do it." So this guy says, "Well, why not?" So he explained. He says, "Well, my wife always gets up and cooks me breakfast. One day I just watched her do this. I was taking a few notes, and after she got done, I gave her a few suggestions on how she could speed things up. And just said she could save time if she didn't make so many trips back and forth to the fridge and carry a few more things together in one hand." And the guy said, "Well, did it work?" He says, "Yeah, it did speed breakfast up. It used to take her 28 minutes to cook breakfast. Now it takes me 22 minutes to do it." I mean, that's the way a lot of people react to advice. That's the way my kids react to advice. And to a great extent, it's the way Blake, our subject today, reacts to anyone else giving him advice. And that's to ignore it. Before diving into a few things about Blake, though, I'd like to say some things about me and my interests in him and what I'm doing talking about a subject like this up here. I teach 18th century British literature, at least that's my research slot at Montana State University. And I specialize in the works of William Blake, who comes at the end of the 18th century. And I don't know why, but I've always been fascinated by proverbs, proverbial sayings. Their linguistic form interests me, their function, and their pervasiveness. And it seems like recently, more than ever, we see proverbs in the popular media, from William Bennett's book, I forget his title, on wisdom. Anybody even read that? Yeah. I mean, it's on the bestseller list for a long time. Someday I suppose I'll have to read it. I can't stomach Bennett often when I see him, but evidently it's interesting. Anyway, Dear Abby's full of advice, proverb form. Most religious traditions have long wisdom traditions. Myths, fables, Aesop's fables, stories, parables, proverbs are an integral part of all those types of literary forms. And I've also been fascinated by William Blake, whom some of you here may have read. I don't know, I mean, you know something about Blake? What is our Blake exposure here? I know my wife's had too much. She always reminds me.
We had it in college, though. We studied one.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people in college have read something, some poetry by him. I I've used to justifying my interest in Blake to my students, justifying my interest in anything. Why do we need to study this? And it's not a bad question, I think, really, to ask and to think about. And if I can just justify for a minute, even though you haven't asked me, you're too polite to ask, I suppose. But there's a number of categories of interest that I use when I'm drawn to something, and many of them apply to a figure like William Blake. Certainly, he's of historical interest. He's a figure that had some historical impact and that can be traced and for simple history reasons. Literature, his literary impact, he wrote a lot of poems that are in the anthologies. He's a canonical poet, so you take a class in 18th or 19th century British literature, you'll read some Blake. I mean, he's also an artist, and so art history is important, some of his artistic images. All of those things I find myself interested in, but more than that, really the reason I'm talking about Blake up here at Holman Village is that he challenges and, I mean, I think I could even use the word augments my own faith in to some extent, which certainly isn't true of everything that I study that I work on. But Blake, who I've just ended up being drawn to and do most of my writing about, I mean, is someone who is connected to things that I believe, which is a nice match. I mean, I thank my stars that I'm able to sort of engage my work life in something that matters to me that much. It doesn't mean that I believe everything that Blake says, nor would I necessarily want you to, and I don't even really consider myself a Blake salesman. But I do feel that he offers a model of reading, and of reading the Bible especially, that I do admire. And his significance for me really lies in that. He's an aggressive reader and a responder and a wrestler with the Bible and with what to do next, that is with Christian witness, which in his works takes a mythic direction so that he produces these endless stories, spinning tales of myths, which is put forth and envisioned in a theology that is a word I don't use very much when I'm teaching this in my classes, but that it, I think it is relevant today. And Blake is relevant in some other interesting fashions because writing when he did at the end of the 18th century, he was an early critic of what would become modern industrial society. And so he looked around him and the growing materialism, the secularization, institutionalized religion, which is a phenomenon not just of the late 18th century, but any time, but the rise of science, all the dehumanizing aspects of modern society that we're well acquainted with, he was becoming first acquainted with and was saying, no thanks. I don't like a lot of what I see. So there'll be a double focus throughout this series of sessions today. One of the focuses will be on biblical wisdom, the biblical wisdom books. The Book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, the three main ones that I'll be talking about, and some other wisdom sprinkled around in the Hebrew Scriptures. So I'll be talking some about the form, the background, the history, the use, and relevance today for us of biblical wisdom. And then the other focus is on Blake's response to biblical wisdom, which really is my primary area of expertise. I don't know Hebrew, but neither did Blake, so that's my defense there. And I'm hoping some of you will bring some expertise in here that will help some discussions. My format that I'd like to use will be to do some introducing today and some show and tell about Blake. And primarily that's what I'll focus on today is an introduction to some of his ideas. And and I'll have some time for your response throughout, and I'm always interruptible, so if I say something that jogs any question, just jump right in, and I'm eminently interruptible. And I'd like to begin with a question about Proverbs. This is a definition question. What exactly is a proverb? What makes a proverb a proverb when you hear the term or you think about it in any context? I mean, what is a proverb? Anybody?
An instruction about life.
Okay, yeah. So instruction is associated with teaching.
Or some guidelines. Some previous experience that avoids and pitfalls.
Okay. Guidelines, so someone is, that seems to imply are based on experience. Someone's learned something and they can pass it on to you. Anything else come to mind?
I was going to add that experiencing. The proverb is some guideline based on maybe even generations of experience.
Mm. Yeah.
To say something is proverbial, proverbial. Proverbially true or constant implies a long range view of.
Yeah, so not just, oh, I learned something yesterday, I'll pass it on, but age old wisdom. I mean, certainly, I think that's a big part of what gets associated with that.
The Proverbs are short.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, if you look up the word proverb in the dictionary, usually the word pithy shows up someplace. Pithy, short sayings of wisdom. And it depends on which context you're talking about, whether that's true or not. I mean, you think of what's a biblical proverb, we're talking about a wisdom tradition, a particular literary form used to express that, which has connections with what you might call the folk proverb tradition. But biblical wisdom has this some specific characteristics, which I'll be talking more in detail about on Wednesday, I guess, is the next time I go. But a couple other things that are associated with proverbs certainly are authority. It's an authoritative statement. When somebody says a proverb, spare the rod, spoil the child, it's an authoritative dictate that has the air, the ring of truth about it. Some other quick characteristics too, besides authority, there's an air of generality about it that is, it's a general wisdom. It's not particular that specifically applies just to you, but can have relevance for anybody. And along with that generality is a universality. Really, I mean, sort of what I use to recognize a proverb, and I think, I mean, it's like a lot of things, we recognize them when we see them. But really, what distinguishes a proverb in context when you're reading someone else is this: the verb tense use. I can start sounding like an English professor. I start talking about grammar for a minute, which doesn't interest me too much. But proverbs are recognized by the fact that they are. Sentences written in the universalizing present tense. You don't put a proverb in the past tense. Oh, if I once spared the rod, I wouldn't have spoiled my child. You put them in this universalizing present tense. If you spare the rod, you'll spoil the child. So it accounts for everything. So most often, that's how you can recognize, wisdom, proverb going on here. So if you read Jesus' parables, he's telling a story. Not all of them, but many of them, will have a proverb stuck in there someplace, like fables often do. At the end, you'll come to some point, which will be some in a proverbial form. And the connections between proverbs and stories, to me, are endlessly fascinating because a proverb is sort of at the opposite continuum of narration. A proverb is distilled, not story. What does the story mean? Well, you get to the proverb. And a story, a narrative, is the far other continuum, and yet they're always connected in fascinating ways, and in the biblical tradition connected too, so that they always go together. You think, when you've got lists of proverbs, you think of the book of Proverbs, it's not a fascinating read. Sit down and read it, there's not much story there. And yet, when you read it, there is story. you read the first chapters of the book of Proverbs, and they're full of this mythic narrative frame that tells some stories about who's speaking this and what is one view of where wisdom comes from. Anyway, authority, general wisdom, universalizing present tense, law, and the authority of law, tradition, all those things are things Blake absolutely hated. He despised them. He couldn't stand anyone giving him advice, telling him what to do, especially society at large, and a society that he saw going down the tubes. It's interesting that someone who hated generalizing wisdom, I mean, one of his phrases that he writes is, to generalize is to be an idiot. It's in particulars that wisdom lies. It's interesting that someone who hated general wisdom would pick the proverb as his trademark literary device, and he really does. All his works are full of proverbs, and it sets up in an interesting puzzle. How could someone who hates proverbs use them so frequently, and what exactly is going on? Are his different from the things he hated, or is he just not living up to the clean hands doctrine or something? That is, he can criticize what he sees in everybody else, but he doesn't necessarily have to follow his own advice. There's some of, I think, all of that going on in what he does. And what I'd like to do is shift to Blake for a minute, and I thought about this. I mean, instead of talking very much about his biography, which is interesting, I'm going to focus more with the time we have today on some of his ideas, the content of ideas and his artistic production. So I've got slides, which I'll get to in a minute, but just a couple scenes here. And the scene now I'd like to shift to is Blake's backyard in London, where he lived. The time is somewhere around 1789. So this is an age of revolution, you think, sort of in broad terms about history going on. You know, the American Revolution, which he was interested in and involved, the French Revolution in that period. And Blake lived from 1757 to 1827. So. When he's stuck in a literary anthology, when you read Blake, if you're taking a British literature course, you usually read Blake when you get to the Romantic movement. So if you think Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, Blake, those are the poets you read together, and you usually think of them as sort of early 19th century poets, and he's really framing that break. So I'm back in Blake's backyard. Someone knocks at the door and finds nobody home and walks through, as they often did at his house, and went into his backyard to see if he was there, and astonished find William and his wife Catherine climbed up in the tree in his backyard, reading and acting out the Garden of Eden scenes from Milton's Paradise Lost, both of them stark naked. And I think, anybody who would read Milton naked, to me, that's an answer enough for why bother reading anybody. That's my answer when students ask me why read Blake. That's what I tell them. There's all kinds of stories. Who knows how many of these are true? The biographies about Blake aren't great, but you can make him sound like a nutcase very quickly. And just a couple examples of that, and that's not my purpose either to make him sound like a nut, but it is to emphasize that he's a religious visionary who looks at the world not like I do, although perhaps like I wish I could more often. He's a painter and a poet, gifted in both, and he made his living as an engraver at an engraving shop. And not a great living because of this visionary quality that he had. So someone would come ask him to illustrate a book, they'd give him an assignment, and he'd illustrate it, and he'd give it back to them, and they would say, "What's this weird thing floating in the sky?" I mean, this is a scene about a little girl walking down a path, and you've got this spook floating in the sky looking down on her. What's that? It's not in the story. And he said, well, yes, it is. You just have to read the story right. So he didn't see in sort of what we might say the normal way. There are stories. He'd walk down the street, he'd see a tree, and I mean, he wrote this in his own journal, and the tree burst into life from the lines of the song we sang the other night, a host of angels singing praises to God. His wife said about him, I have very little of Mr. Blake's company, he's always in paradise. I spoke to you naked in paradise. I was in London a couple summers ago and saw a play about Blake, and I mean, of course, they would have had, they opened the play with that scene, and there they are up there in this tree. So, his brother died when he was 20, a younger brother he's very close with, and I mean, after he died, he came back and had conversations with his brother Robert. In fact, his brother Robert, who Blake said, told him the printing method that he used to make his illuminated books then, which was a technique that Blake invented, whether it was Robert or William, one of the two invented, and Blake sort of worked on it and perfected it. But he did say it came from the other side. And there's other stories. I mean, this makes me really nutty. I mean, he's from an early channeler. His friends would come over and ask me to paint dead people. You know, I'd say, oh, can you come paint John the First? He'd say, okay, and he'd sit there for a while, and pretty soon he'd start drawing. When one time he stopped his sketch in the middle, and he said, well, what's wrong? He says, well, I'm waiting for Queen Elizabeth to get out of the way. I mean, who knows? I mean, I think part of this, he's having fun. He as a prophet, often you don't think of prophets having a sense of humor, at least the ones I've read. I mean, I think Blake does, and sometimes he's just having fun. But he, in terms of his politics, he was interested in revolution. He was a growing radical, although he kept his head down most of the time, and it wasn't safe not to keep your head down. What he did was he published these artistic books, and not in any great runs. There's 20 copies of his things, or 8 copies that are in existence now. I probably have a few more that have been lost. So he's not widely known, but he is hanging around with political extremists and radicals. Tom Paine hangs around his house. Mary Wollstonecraft, which that's a real interesting relationship between those two. Early defender of women's rights are part of a circle that he's involved in. And his individualism led him ultimately to deciding to address the public directly with no intermediary, I mean, in his artistic ethic also, so that he wouldn't just publish poetry books in the normal way, give it to a printer and have the printer set it, because that would be letting someone else put their hands on his works, which in his view would kill it. So what he did, he invented this technique, and I'll show you the slides here in a minute, and designed, printed, illustrated in one sort of piece books that looked something like this. I've got one copy here. I haven't been to the bookstore, but I haven't ordered some of these. This is a facsimile copy of one of his illuminated books, A Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which, I mean, this is the book that's been called the most perfect English book in existence. And the problem with the facsimile is it's got a lot of notes in between, and so you don't quite get the same effect. But this looks more or less what Blake would have put together. I mean, it was quite small, and it's an etched, hand-colored plate then with a design and words on it, a poem, a prophetic poem. And I can send this around while I'm talking to you, I'll just flip through that. So what he did, he started producing these things. He's got a series of them that he worked on throughout his life. They got more and more complicated and longer as he went along, more impenetrable in some sense. His first successful work after his experiments with etching in that fashion, it's fairly complicated. I mean, etching, you do things in reverse. So he's writing in reverse with a gum on copper plates, and then having them get an acid bath and then you'd print these. And sometimes you'd write front words on a piece of paper and stick that so that it would reverse the printing. His first successful work at that festival was The Songs of Innocence, which I think is when most people read Blake, that's what they get exposed to. His children's poems, Songs of Innocence, 1789, and then later Songs of Experience, which 1792, which afterwards he almost published those two together in one single book. But he has a number of other works that which titles aren't that familiar, a couple of which I'll talk about this week. Marriage, Heaven, and Hell, which that one is, which is really my favorite. That's the one where most of his proverbs show up in a long list, and it's, that is his book of proverbs. What he does in his works is respond to the biblical wisdom tradition and a lot of other things, but really his body of works can be seen as a systematic correction of biblical wisdom books. So that's his book of Proverbs. His next one, Visions of the Daughters of Albion, really is his redoing of Job. And later work before Zoas is his engagement of Ecclesiastes. And then he keeps going when he runs out of wisdom books and starts bringing gospel wisdom as well and writing wisdom books that the Bible never managed to produce either, in his view. And what he thought he was doing here, I mean, it's fascinating to me, really, is, I mean, he's working in the Protestant tradition, and you could say the radical Protestant tradition, and that is putting the Bible into the hands of the people and reading it aggressively. And his conclusions were that the Bible over the years has become encrusted by years of bad theology on one hand, so people just saying the wrong thing about it so you can't see what's really there anymore, but also by bad editors so that the thing that's in your hand really isn't God's word completely. Or it's there, but it takes a little bit of energetic work to find it. Now, I mean, that's something that I want to just say a little bit more about. I mean, that sounds a lot like Gnosticism. That is, that there's this mystery in the Bible. You have to learn this guy's system to be able to understand what the Bible really means, and creating this individualized secret system that you can become enlightened into. And I think, you know, a lot of people over the years that have been interested in Blake, and scholars writing about Blake, are interested in that Gnostic element in Blake's work, which myself, I'm not terribly interested in. And in fact, I think that's really that's miscasting Blake. He's not a Gnostic, I don't think, at all. I mean, for him, the gospel vision is as simple as it is for Paul, who says in his response to the Gnostics, it doesn't take a lot of effort and mystic revelation. Here it is. That the message of the gospel is God wants everyone around the table at once. And for Blake, that's the simple message as well. So he's writing a series of prophetic illuminated books. Just a couple more things I'll say, and I'll get to my slides. Couple keys to his thinking. I mean, when you first encounter Blake, he does look weird, bizarre, nutty, as the stories about him make him sound, and impenetrably Gnostic. And yet, with just a couple things kept in mind, I think he starts to make more and more sense. I mean, one, that's what I already alluded to, he is a radical Protestant. And by that, I mean, I'm thinking Luther, or in his own time, Wesley, even. The term, I think, applies to Wesley to a lot of extent. And Blake, I mean, he carried everything to extremes, and what that means in his mind, he was such a Protestant that no church could ever hold him. He would always fight with the pastor or with the other people around him. So he ended up being out sort of on his own. He joined churches, Emanuel Swedenborg's church he got excited about for a little while in London, but went once, and decided it was the same old thing. I mean, in fact, and that's why I can argue that Blake's not a Gnostic. You can say Swedenborg's works seem sort of in that Gnostic tradition, and Blake can't stand it because it's the same old institutionalized, not secret religion, which Blake couldn't stand. Another thing about him, I mean, if he's a radical Protestant, he hated conventional authority of any kind, especially imposed conventional authority. Anything from above, he'll react to. So give him advice, he'll react to that. So he's a radical individualist. He always believed in going to the source, as any good mystic does, and that means going to God, where you can find God in the Bible, or through experience, or reading Milton naked, or whatever you want to do. That taken to the extreme generates his artistic method, that is, conventional authority he hates, convention in his own works he hates, which means that he deliberately baffles, confuses, to people's imaginations so that they will have to wrestle with what's there, and so that Blake himself won't become systematic and conventional. I mean, and this gets carried to, I mean, what you might say is a nutty extreme. So when he's putting together his Songs of Innocence and Experience, every of all the 20 editions of that are different. Not one is the same, partly because he's hand-coloring them and his wife Catherine is helping paint them too. But he would change the etchings on each one so that, I mean, in one, some guy figured the bottom is looking at you, one is looking away, he would change the age. I mean, this constant shifting. He would take some of the Songs of Innocence and put them in Songs of Experience just to see what would happen so that things wouldn't stay the same. And all, what that happens when he starts writing his long mythic works is it makes them very hard to read because the conventions of narration that we're used to when someone tells a story, there's characters, there's plot, somebody's doing something to someone else. He starts to play around with, I mean, this would be done throughout the 19th century, and then later with Joyce and other people. I mean, saying, well, what happens if I get rid of some of these narrative conventions? I mean, what happens if some readers say, well, I can't read this anymore, let's look at something else. But part of what he's doing, he's got characters, their names start to change, so you don't know who's who anymore. And they change before your eyes, and part of the point is that change, energetic metamorphosis, and also this catch me if you can, you have to follow me. We're talking about the Bible study today. I mean, the hermeneutic dictum that is, interpret this work. Go back to the Bible and read it yourself. That's what's important here. And certainly that's what Blake is asking you to read him, but then to read the Bible also as well. A couple other quick things. Mythology permeates his work. He has a mythic imagination, which means he's telling stories. He's inventing these characters with weird names, and if you read Blake, you become familiar with these. You just sort of figuring out who's who. This is some of the part. I mean, it's interesting, but it's not really the thing that I'm that worried about. But what he starts to do, he tells one story, and he says, "Okay, that's nice, but that's not really it." And he'll tell another one, and another one, and another one, and you start to see that they're all telling the same thing. But he's never given you one central key unlocking the truth story. I mean, all we can do is continue to generate new stories in the same way that, say, I mean, I always go back to Jesus' parables that he's doing when he's telling parables. He tells a parable, they don't get it, he says, well, I'll explain to you what this means, and he starts to give out some proverbial wisdom, giving you the moral of the story. But pretty soon, to explain the parable of the sower, Jesus is simply telling you another parable, and another one, and the stories become commenting on the other stories more than saying, okay, here is the secret truth which I'm about to reveal to you. That's Blake's method, certainly as well. Let me turn on my slides, and I'll make lights dim for this. I'm going to rush through a few of these because I've got one thing that I'd like to pass out to you too. It's part of your work to do today. This is a plate from The Marriage, Heaven, and Hell, which I had sent around. You can see there's text and then an illustration. And it's the one on the right that I'm interested in. That figure is referred to as the renovated man. He's dreaming dreams and seeing visions. particular, it's a little cartoon right underneath it. This is my response to people who read Blake as a Gnostic. And this is Blake giving you advice on how to read him and how to read anything, which is his, one of his grand themes. I think you can sort of see those little figures there. I mean, this is Blake on reading and on education. So way over there on the left, are you with me? I'm above the words, just those little tiny figures. And there's a winged mother figure playing with what looks like a little blob. It's a little baby. She's got it in her, it looks like it can't even walk yet.
Are you talking about right here?
Yeah, you see that?
That's the baby?
Yeah. I mean, I've got Xeroxes of this that I'll pass out tomorrow or Wednesday. But take my word for it if you can't quite see that. There's a little winged fairy figure playing with a baby. So how do you educate a kid? There's lots of debates about this in the 18th century and Rousseau on sort of what do you do. You play first. Then the middle panel, sort of squiggly lines, time goes on. And there you've got an adult on the right, and on the left, the youth now, reading something together. You can see the youth's pointing at a book which is there. Can't see the book here, but presumably it's there. I mean, what I like about that, I think what the point is, it's not a lecture format, so I mean, what I'm doing right now is about as anti-Blakean as you can get. And I'm sitting here telling you things about Blake. What I really should have done is start with these slides and let you point to things and say some things, so I'll let you do that. So what's important there is the learner is the one with the energy involved. It's not being lectured to. And then, over there on the right, in a bower, is that figure, perhaps older now, reading a book by him or herself. So now you no longer have someone sitting next to you telling you how to read or even responding. It's you and the text. And if things happen properly, correctly, what you get is the big scene up above, which is enlightenment. So books for Blake can get you as close to enlightenment as possible, but if you'll notice in this picture, in some of his color versions, this is a lot clearer because this is the book here, just made part of the hill, but that's actually the book under his hand. He's no longer needing, he's sitting on it with his skull over there too. So, I mean, it's like Joseph Campbell talks about, I mean, one of his definitions of myth. Myth is penultimate truth. It's never ultimate truth. It can only get you a step away from truth. And then, I mean, here's someone that's experiencing revelation. And a book is useful, but ultimately you don't need the book. What Blake wants, when he's talking about reading himself, you can read Blake or you can not read Blake. It doesn't matter if you know Blake and know his system and know his mythic figures. It doesn't matter. He wants you to get rid of him. What he wants is direct apocalypse. And it really is an apocalyptic vision that he's after. Let me just flip through a couple more here. This is a title page. Bad slide, but Songs of Innocence and Experience. And I've got another copy just to show you some of the changes that he made. I mean, it's quite different. See, the colors are completely different, and if you have time, you can look at the figures. They're actually different. I mean, that's an Adam and Eve figure, fallen now, fire around them. And then this is the single title page for the Songs of Innocence. I mean, all these all kinds of details here that are fascinating to me, but I'll skip those details for today because I do. There's another version. You see the colors are a little different. That's the title page, and the frontispieces are on the left. And the speaker of the Songs of Innocence is this piper who's running around, this youth piping, and there's his muse flying up above his head. And then the Songs of Experience, there's someone's died over there on the right. And the bard, the prophetic bard, is speaking these poems, and his muse no longer is floating above his head, but he has to be held sort of physically and stuck up there. This is just one of his famous poems, Songs of Innocence, which I won't read through. There's more famous ones from the Songs of Experience, the Tiger. A lot of people have heard Blake's poem, The Tiger. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? These tigers never look very much like tigers to me, but state of natural history at the end of the century. A couple other quick comments. Blake's classic themes are the fall and redemption. That's what he's interested in. Here's an illustration to Milton's Paradise Lost that he did, the Temptation of Eve, one of his versions of this scene. And here's his expulsion from Eden, also from the same illustration set. And one thing that I would like to say about how he envisioned what happened at the fall myths permeate everything that he writes. There's never one version that you can say, this is it, this is what happened. I mean, the way he viewed the Adam and Eve myth was, that's one version of the story, but that's not the only version either. But one of the ways that is consistent in Blake's view is, picture the earth as flat. And at the fall, Adam and Eve, if you want their names, ate the apple, and the flat world turned physically upside down, which is the state of things now. We're walking around upside down on our heads. So what we think is up is really down in a cosmic sense. So if you follow the implications of that, for Blake, people wandering around now thinking that's up when it's really down are worshiping a god who isn't really God. That's the wrong god, and in fact, that's the god who creeps into the Bible through misled, fallen editors, so that you have to get through that before you can really understand what's going on. Does that make sense? So organized religion's God is always the wrong one. And the wrong one is pictured in the religious tradition. I mean, here's Michelangelo's Creation of Adam from the Sistine Chapel. Remember what God looks like. And here's God, that old guy with the beard. That old guy with the beard, for Blake, isn't God. That's the wrong one. And here's Blake's version of God creating Adam. And it's sort of this hideous Dr. Frankenstein. You can see, there's his old man version of God, who in his myth is often named Urizen, creating Adam. But I mean, here it's more like this spook sucking the life out of this already dead creature. So part of what Blake wants is to not see that God, but to see another one. And the God that he's most interested in, the only one he can comprehend that makes any sense to him, is the incarnate one, that's Jesus. So keep that in mind. And here's some other images then of that wrong God. See over there on the left, an old guy with a crutch being led by a child. And over there on the right, that same old guy with his hair braided and tied into the earth to which that god is too tied. He viewed him as being a god of science, a god of Newton and John Locke, and a materialism who takes his compass and draws circles and leads to the deism around his time that Blake couldn't stand. So that was his preoccupation with the fall. He's also preoccupated with redemption, meaning it's never just the one. So here's Jesus being commissioned and sent off from Paradise Lost also. And there's, before the fall, the battle in heaven. And here's the title page, The Married Femme in Hell, which I'll talk more about tomorrow. So, I love that play.
I have a question.
Okay.
So, Blake's drawing of God is almost like he's mocking the normal or the traditional view of God. He's mocking it, not so that he really feels God is this grotesque figure tied to the ground or whatever. He doesn't think that's really God. It's mocking the real, the norm view.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, he'll have an old guy God that sometimes he does like, but most of the time when he's got old man God, he's thinking biblical Hebrew scriptures, Yahweh, which is the imposer, the lawgiver, the imposer of conventional authority, which always leads to oppression. There's some of the, you can even say the anti-Semitism of Blake's own time in that traditional view of Hebrew scriptures of that time, certainly. So that old guy God isn't the real God. The real God was that renovated man looking up to the sky. I mean, that's a Jesus figure.
Right. So when he draws all these God figures, he's more mocking the corruption of.
Right. Mocking, but in another sense, they're real because people believe in them. And if you believe in them, they have force. So they exist. And so many of his myths that he writes, his stories, are, I mean, they look like psychomachias. That is, he's telling stories about Albion, his England, his universal man, or just anybody. And there's all these God figures at war in this guy's head and doing the wrong things. Sometimes they get outside his head, and then they start taking over the world. And I mean, to get to regenerated, they have to be put back in their right place. And the everyman has to see things correctly and see things clearly. And the way to see clearly is tied to wisdom. The way to see things the right way doesn't mean to see things the way Blake does, although there's always that subtext, you think. If you just do what I do, you get it. But really what he's saying, if you read energetically yourself, if you speak wisdom properly yourself, and that's really the key here, which we'll talk more about. The proverb for Blake is a language bomb. That's how I refer to it. When he reads the Bible, that's how he's getting it out of the Bible. He tracks how he's doing that. It's a language bomb. When you say a proverb, things happen. It's not just imposing my view of the world on you. You're creating possibilities of redemption, but at the same time, if the language has that much power, and you think first lines of John here, if language has that much power, if the wrong people are speaking it or saying it in the wrong way, then you're going to have oppression universalized. And that's what will always happen. Because people always will universalize and will always institutionalize. It's inevitable. So the process of redemption for Blake is always continuous. You always have to be fighting against institutionalization. Now, before I run out of time, what I did, I've got for you I put a quiz on here. We'll call this a Shalom quiz, so you don't have to worry about this. It won't be graded, and you can do this with a friend or a new friend. So if you could, just quickly look through this. Here's the instructions. There are proverbs from four sources on here. This is my 4 B's Proverbs quiz. There's Blake Proverbs. There's bureaucratic Proverbs, which I guess our ruling bureaucrat is Bill these days. So my initial state's name, this used to be, when I first wrote this up, it was Bush. I think it worked better. He spoke more in bureaucratic language. And some of these are Ben Franklin. And some of these are from the Bible, particularly from the book of Proverbs. So let me give you the first four so you can, I'll give you a clue here.
So if we write B all the way
that's
down.
Right. That's right. That's the easy way to do this. If you want to take more risks, then try to figure this out. So the first one, a stitch in time saves nine. Who's that?
Ben.
That's Ben. Ben Franklin. You've heard that one before, probably. A stitch in time saves nine. So that's Ben Franklin. The only reason I picked his is because he writes Proverbs and he's roughly contemporary to Blake, actually. Missiles of lateness or petrous consistency have the potential of fracturing my osseous structure, but the Appalachian will eternally remain obnoxious.
A stitch
in
rocks
and stones will break
my bones, but names will never come.
Yeah, sticks and stones, that's the translation. So that's...
Jeez, how did you know that? That was really good.
It tests your vocabulary. So that's our bureaucrat. 3, the wicked is driven away in his wickedness, but the righteous has his hope in death. What's that? Yeah, that's the book of Proverbs. Right out of the book of Proverbs. The wicked is driven away in his wickedness, but the righteous has his hope in death. I mean, if I can editorialize, I mean, that's sort of, I mean, what I'll talk about on Wednesday. That's the heart of the book of Proverbs. The law of distributive justice, the good will get rewarded, and the bad will be punished. In an orderly world, that's life. And it's a wonderful vision. I mean, the wisdom of Ecclesiastes and Job's response by saying, that's not what happens, so how can we deal with this? And the fourth one, the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction.
That's a speed play.
There's one. That's one of his famous ones. So if they're weird, they're Blake. If you've heard it before, they're Ben. If they talk about wickedness, they're the Bible. And if you can't understand them, they're the bureaucrats. So go ahead and take a few minutes. And you can do this if you want by yourself, or you can talk to the person next to you.
Don't cry.
Five must be biblical. Six must be
biblical. I don't know.
As the bird by wandering, the soul by finding the father. Seven must be grace.
No cheating.
No cheating.
And don't cry over spilled milk. Stay here.
Yeah, that's pure crash. Nine is Franklin.
Okay,
that's the interesting thing about this. When you start putting Blake's with the Bible, you say,
sooner murder an infant's cradle than a nurse and active desire. That's what I like.
Not
before
his Rolling Stone catches the moss. 16, right?
Yeah. Oh, is it?
Yeah.
17 could be bloody.
16.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Must be bureaucratic.
Well.
We haven't had many bureaucratic ones there, have we?
Or you want to go over this, because I don't want to keep people past time.
So we have a couple more minutes?
This is sort of fun.
It is.
Avoid extremes, forbear resisting injuries as much as you can.
That sounds bureaucratic.
Yeah, but what's the, is that actually said, is that one of those where it's simple or language?
But it is a combination of cruel.
I don't know.
Burning the candle with both ends.
Dead men.
Dead men.
Tell no tales.
Well, we just had a four.
Resolve to perform what you ought, perform not fail with resolve.
Dead men tell no tales.
Sounds like them.
Yeah, it does.
Also sounds.
Let's be very clear, you ought.
Also sounds.
Come on. Ben.
Pre-wise, every time you'll make clear things to pass out.
I don't know.
That could be terrible.
Are you gonna tell the answer?
Yeah, I will. And that's. You tell me when you're ready for me to run through.
Okay, 25, 24 must be Blake's response to 25. Is that a fair statement?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
I think two more.
Yeah, he's good.
I'm curious, give me the answers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me run through. Okay, I'll just start at the top. A stitch in time saves night, we do the first four. Five. Take fast hold of instruction, let her not go, keep her, for she is thy life. That's Book of Proverbs.
Where are you now?
Number five.
Five is biblical.
So that's Book of Proverbs, and the she that they're talking about is instruction, and I mean, wisdom is personified as a woman in Hebrew, wisdom tradition. Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, wise.
Yeah.
That's Ben, you've all heard that. As the bird by wandering is a swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come.
I'm
that's Bible.
Well,
I mean, and part of the key there, as you can see, the wisdom tradition is always telling you the world's in an orderly place. If you're having bad luck, you deserve it. So the curse causeless shall not come. That's Book of Proverbs version. If you get to Ecclesiastes, then it will not be the same. It's bootless to become lachrymose or precipitously decanted lacteal fluid.
Two.
Don't.
That's bureaucrat. What does it mean?
Bureaucrat.
Yeah, okay, you guys are good. A penny saved is a penny earned. Ben. Robin Redbreast in a cage puts all heaven in a rage.
Blake.
That's Blake. He that trusts in his own heart is a fool. That's the Book of Proverbs. So don't trust yourself. Instead, I mean, there's another half of that one. Trust God or trust the wise. Pulchritude possesses solely cutaneous profundity. Bureaucratic. I heard
beauty
someone. Beauty is skin deep. Sooner murder an infant in its cradle and nurse unacted desires. That's one of Blake's most famous ones. I mean, and what he's saying there is you act on your desire. And I mean, his ethic of, I mean, including his sexual ethic was, say, 60s free love. He brought home a woman at one time to his wife and said, look, I'm going to live out my artistic ethic. And she said, get her out of here. So.
Did he? Did he listen to his wife?
Yes.
Oh, good.
He knew what was good for her. Eat not to fullness, drink not to elevation. That's Ben. Ben's, you'll notice, are always right in the middle. He wants the middle way. That's the 18th
century. Moderation.
Yeah. 18 is in Greek characters. 15, a vocable to the sapient is adequate. Yeah, bureaucratic version of that. A revolving lithic conglomerate accumulates no conjures a small green brachytic plant.
Rolling stone.
That's bureaucratic. Rolling stone gathers no moss. He who desires but acts not breeds pestilence. That's a Blake central.
Desire is a big word for him.
Desire, yeah.
That's what I said.
I mean, and you can see what he's doing with that, I mean, in the marriage of heaven and hell, he's taking Jesus' words literally. When Jesus is talking about the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount, talking about how to treat those, I mean, he's saying, if you look at another woman, I say, it's not just if you committed
adultery.
If you lust after someone, you've done it. And Blake is saying, right, that's exactly right. So he's taking the corollary of that saying, do it.
The Nike commercial.
Yeah, right, just do it. The desire accomplished is sweet to the soul, but it is abomination to fools to depart from evil. That's Book of Proverbs. So, you can see Blake's interesting connection here. I mean, the first half of that, the desire accomplished is sweet to the soul. What Blake is doing is saying, right, that's true. And he's just forgetting the second half of that biblical proverb, which is the point of the biblical proverb. But if you depart from evil, you're a fool. Dip him in the river who loves water, and he that waters shall be watered also himself, is another pairing. And that's what I want to do on Wednesday, is look at some of his parents. One's Blake, one's the Bible.
Which one's which?
First one's Blake. Yeah. First one's Blake, second one's the Bible. How do you know?
I don't know. What is he that waters shall be watered?
Well, one's in Hebrew and one's in English.
Yeah.
Well, one has to deal with what the person wants.
He that waters. Yeah. I mean, it's in the biblical form, he that waters shall be watered. So if you're taking care of a garden, you'll receive back from God.
Oh, okay.
If you do good to others, you will get good back on you.
Giving is better than.
And Blake's dip him in the river who loves water. I mean, it sounds very similar, and it's literalizing the biblical proverbs.
Different strokes for different folks.
Avoid extremes. Forbear resisting injuries as much as you think they deserve. That's Ben. Middle way. Male cadavers are incapable of revealing any testimony.
Bureaucratic.
Yeah. Dead men tell no tales. Resolve to perform what you ought and perform without fail what you resolve. That's Ben. Ben's a boring one. Prudence is a rich, ugly old maid courted by incapacity.
Wait.
That's Blake's response to the opening of the Book of Proverbs, which says, the wise in heart shall be called prudence. And Blake says, that's the wrong God that would say that. Prudence can never...